Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. My name is pedantically Marcus Freestone. This episode is Gurdjieff and self-remembering, and it follows on directly from the previous episode, Ouspensky and Negative Thinking. If you haven't heard the previous episode and you don't know who Gurdjieff and Ouspensky are, then I highly, strongly, very much recommend that you listen to episode 15, or this one won't make much sense. Sorry if you find it sort of aggressive to be asked to, you know, listen to a previous episode of a free podcast. If you do, then you're probably, you know, not going to get much out of this. So last week we looked at Ouspensky and Negative Thinking. This week we're going to look at Gurdjieff's methods for self-observation and how to overcome negative thinking and wrong types of thinking. I was intending to post some links to some YouTube videos about Gurdjieff and Ouspensky with this episode, but I looked at several and none of them are really the sort of thing that I think is relevant. As I said in the last episode, some of what Gurdjieff and Ouspensky wrote and talked about was, in my opinion, complete nonsense. Stuff about the rays of creation and all this sort of numerological or sort of astrological stuff about the universe and a lot of nonsense, but a good half of it is proper sound practical psychological stuff, so that's what we're focusing on. But just beware, if you do look at Gurdjieff and Ouspensky online, you will find a lot of nonsense. You will also find, as I have recently, that an awful lot of other people who are around now are talking about these sort of ideas. I think Eckhart Tolle, or I've read the short version of his book, the title of which escapes me, and my bookcase is in the other room, so I can't see it. Oh, the Power of Now, I think. Yeah. His ideas are very similar to Gurdjieff, as are quite a lot of the sort of spiritual, in inverted commas, ideas that you will find on YouTube. Some of it I agree with, some of it I don't, but then my philosophy is just absorb as much as possible, take in as much as you can, as many different ideas, and just pick what works for you. You know, the hippie spiritual stuff doesn't work for me, so I ignore it. I focus on the psychological and the existential, but, you know, it's up to you. If you find the other stuff useful, then by all means, use it. Anyway, I was thinking recently about some ideas that very much tie in with and develop Gurdjieff's work, so I'm going to talk about them before we have another couple of readings from Gurdjieff and go into self-remembering and his methods for counteracting negative thinking. I was thinking the other day that maybe anxiety is a different type of thinking. Productive thinking is where you cogently plan something for the future and make decisions, or where you are actually physically in a situation and are doing things, completing tasks, etc. Anxiety is an unproductive form of emotional thinking, where you don't engage the intellect and therefore nothing gets done, no decisions are made, and therefore the thing you're worrying about is never overcome. And this is the sort of wrong thinking that Gurdjieff and Ouspensky very much focused on in a lot of their work. And in when I, as you know, when you go on YouTube and you look for one thing and you get loads of, you get an endless infinity of links for endless infinity. That's an oxymoron. Anyway, you get a lot of links to other things that are similar by keywords or title, or sometimes, I admit, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why has that come up when I put that in? But anyway, a lot of the stuff that came up was about was YouTube videos with titles like How to Stop Thinking. And that kind of seems a bit counterintuitive. Well, why would you want to stop thinking? But that then, while I looked at some of those videos and I thought, no, that's really not my sort of thing, most of it. But it made me think that about what I've just said, that, yeah, maybe there are different types of thinking, and that there's not just positive and negative thinking, but there's productive and counterproductive thinking. And what we have to do is not to learn not to think, because that would be ridiculous and negate us as human beings. What we have to do is learn to focus on productive thinking and learn to overcome this unproductive thinking. And I think that there is a tangible difference between productive and unproductive, and positive and negative. I think it's a different category of thinking. I've always been told since I was a kid, oh, you think too much. And I definitely do. But I've come to realise recently that that's the wrong way of phrasing it. It's more a case of thinking about the wrong things. Things that aren't currently happening. Things from the past. Things from the future that don't exist yet, most of which never will exist. Annoying or draining people who you won't be seeing for days or weeks to come, yet the very idea of being in their company or past memories of them is enough to grind you down. This is all pointless, unproductive, counterproductive, negative thinking of exactly the type that I was just talking about. There's no point thinking about a situation that you're not currently in unless you're actively planning it. I've said this before in the book or in a previous podcast. There's no point thinking about a situation that is not currently in front of you, or a person who isn't currently physically present. Not that this is an easy thing to enact, of course. I've been trying to live by this for 20 odd years and I still mostly fail because it takes so much effort and discipline. But the point is that I've mentioned before, I've wasted a lot of my life in a state of anxiety, worrying about thousands and thousands of things, and not a single one of them ever actually happened. It's a complete fiction in my head, and I can't be the only one. I know I'm not. So what we have to do is get rid of this unproductive thinking and focus on the productive, and I think that's where Gurdjieff comes in. After a little musical interlude, we will have a short reading from Auspensky's The Fourth Way, where he talks about it's just a reminder of Gurdjieff's method, and then we're going to go on to look at self-remembering, which is Gurdjieff's, what he called the work, his method for overcoming negative and unproductive thinking. From the point of view of self-study and of work to attain one I, we must understand the process by which we may come from this plurality to oneness. It is a complicated process and has different stages. Between the present state of plurality of I's and the one controlling I we wish to attain, there are certain stages of development which must be studied. But first we must understand that there are certain formations in us, without knowing which we cannot understand how we eventually come from our present state to the state of one I, if it is possible for us. Although a great many of our I's are disconnected and do not even know one another, they are divided into certain groups. This does not mean that they are divided consciously, they are divided by circumstances of life. These groups of eyes manifest themselves as roles that a man plays in his life. Everybody has a certain number of roles. One corresponds to one set of conditions, another to another, and so on. Man himself seldom notices these differences. For instance, he has one role for his work, another for his home, yet another among friends, another if he is interested in sport, and so on. These roles are easier to observe in other people than in oneself. People are often so different in different conditions that these roles become quite obvious and well-defined, but sometimes they are better hidden, or even played only inside without any external manifestations. All people, whether they know it or not, whether they wish it or not, have certain roles which they play. This acting is unconscious. If it could be conscious, it would be quite different, but one never notices how one passes from one role to another. Or if one notices it, one persuades oneself that one is doing it for a purpose, that it is a conscious action. In reality, the change is always controlled by circumstances. It cannot be controlled by man himself, because he himself does not exist yet. Sometimes there are definite contradictions between one and another role. In one role, one says one thing, has certain definite views and convictions. Then one passes into another role and has absolutely different convictions and says absolutely different things, without noticing it, or else thinking that one does it on purpose. There are very definite causes which prevent man from seeing the difference between one role or mask and another. These causes are certain artificial formations called buffers. Buffer is a very good name for these appliances. Buffers between railway carriages prevent clashing, diminish the shock. It is the same with buffers between different roles and different groups of eyes or personalities. People can live with different personalities without them clashing. And if these personalities have no external manifestation, they exist internally all the time. It is very useful to try to find what buffers are. Try to find how one lies to oneself with the help of buffers. Suppose one says, "I never argue." Then if one really has a good conviction that one never argues, one can argue as much as one likes and never notice it. This is the result of a buffer. If one has a certain number of good buffers, one is quite safe from unpleasant contradictions. Buffers are quite mechanical. A buffer is like a wooden thing. It does not adapt, but it plays its part very well. It prevents one seeing contradictions. That there is a perfect description not only of Sartre's concept of bad faith that we've covered in depth in previous episodes and in the book, but also the psychological phenomena of cognitive dissonance. And this was a few decades before, psychology came up with cognitive dissonance, and I think these ideas were also around before Sartre came up with bad faith. So this is the origin of ideas that are very much out there in the mainstream now, however esoteric some of the language admittedly might sound now. But come on, this is written nearly 100 years ago. So now we're going to have a final reading from Auspensky's The Fourth Way, where he talks about self-remembering, which is very much the core of the work. And after that, I'm going to conclude by telling you about how I try to use self-remembering and how I have at times successfully used it in my own life to overcome negative emotions. If you return to the beginning, you will remember what was said about the absence of consciousness in man and the fact that when a man realizes it, this realization gives him the possibility of acquiring consciousness. And you will see that this is the direction in which man can develop. As long as he does not realize that he is simply a machine and that all his processes are mechanical, he cannot begin to study himself, for this realization is the beginning of self-study. So study must begin in this way. We must realize that we do not possess self-consciousness, that we cannot be aware of ourselves at moments of action or thought. This is the first step. The second step is to realize that we do not know ourselves. We do not know our machine and how it works. And the next step is to realise that we have to study methods of self-study. We observe ourselves all our life, but we do not know what self-observation means. Real self-observation must be based on facts. So one of the first points is how to remember oneself, how to be more conscious. It is not enough to admit this absence of consciousness in oneself. One has to see it in actual fact, to verify it from personal observation. We do not realise what consciousness is and what it implies. If one became conscious for half an hour, it is incredible what one can see and learn. So it is an aim in itself because of what it brings, and it also means a step towards objective consciousness. It is necessary to speak a little about this, about what is meant by the 4 degrees of consciousness man can possess. If we take it from the point of view of cognition of truth, then in sleep we cannot know the difference between what is true and what is not true. Things we see in dreams all look alike. In the waking state, we already have more opportunity to recognise the difference between things. The shape of things is made out by our eye, the surface of things by touch, and to a certain extent, we can orientate ourselves by the perceptions of our instruments of sense. So there is an objective element, but we ourselves remain subjective to ourselves. When we become self-conscious, we become objective to ourselves, and in objective consciousness, we can know objective truths about everything. These are the degrees of consciousness. Question: must we change our knowledge in order to see things as they really are and know the truth? Answer: no, in this state of consciousness we cannot come to things as they are. We have to change our state of consciousness. But we can take off some layers of lying. Things are surrounded by lying. We can take off 1, 2, or 3 skins and come nearer to real things. Question: I am not clear about higher consciousness. Could we at least know how to think about it? Answer: we realise the possibility of higher consciousness when we realise that we are not conscious at all. We are conscious only at rare moments, without possibility of control. Now we are in 2 states, in sleep and half awake. Theoretical comparisons of states of consciousness and descriptions in words will not help. But when we begin to awake, we realise the state in which we are now. It is necessary to find moments of self-remembering, and then, in these moments, you will see the difference. By studying yourself, you will see that you can be very near to sleep, or you can be near to self-consciousness. So study begins with a study of these different states in ourselves. For instance, when we take ourselves as one, or do not think about it, then we are nearly asleep. But when we begin to divide ourselves and know that at every moment it is only one I or one group of I's speaking, then we are nearer to self-consciousness, nearer to objective facts. There are different ways of studying consciousness in oneself. In the beginning, the first thing is the realisation that one cannot be conscious when one wants to. The best time to realise this is after you have been speaking or doing something. Suppose you have been talking about some important business or writing a letter. Then ask yourself, was I conscious at that time? The second thing, in the beginning, is the realisation that you are not one, that you have many different eyes. Question: how is one to recognise when one is self-conscious? Answer: you will know. It is quite a different feeling. If you try to be conscious for a moment and then compare it with another moment when you did not try to be conscious, you will see the difference. It cannot be described. One moment you are aware of yourself, another moment you are not. You do things, you speak, you write, and you are not conscious. Only you must remember that it is said from the very beginning that we must study not only states of consciousness, but also obstacles to consciousness. So we must study them and then remove them. All these obstacles are in ourselves. External circumstances we cannot change. We have to take them as they are and change inwardly in these circumstances. Question: If you observe yourself for a moment, are you conscious at that moment? Answer: not necessarily. It may be quite mechanical. But if you are conscious at the same time that you observe, the line of your attention will resemble two arrows, one showing attention directed on the thing you observe and another on yourself. Question: I cannot understand the link between self-observation and self-remembering. How to begin? What to do? Answer: self-remembering is an attempt to be aware of yourself. Self-observation is always directed at some definite function. Either you observe your thoughts, or movements, or emotions, or sensations. It must have a definite object which you observe in yourself. Self-remembering does not divide you. You must remember the whole. It is simply the feeling of I, of your own person. They may come together, particularly at later stages, and then you will be able to do both at the same time, observe something definite, or recognize manifestations in yourself, and remember yourself. But in the beginning, the two things are different. You begin with self-observation, that is the normal way, and through self-observation you realize that you do not remember yourself. When you realize that, and at a very rare moment you do remember yourself, then any person who is not definitely prejudiced will be able to understand that it is possible to increase these moments of self-remembering. And then you try to do it. So, the way that I try to practice this self-remembering and self-observation is very much like what Ouspensky was just saying there about it being dividing yourself in two. When I am experiencing a negative or an unproductive thought or emotion, I try to... Firstly, I try to halt my train of thought. We all know how hard that is, how you get onto a train of thought, be it positive or negative, and then you just get carried away with it, and 5 minutes later you can't remember where that train of thought began. And this takes practice, but it is eminently possible. You can arrest your train of thought. So that's the first thing. If you're going into a negative spiral, if you're going into unproductive thinking, then it's halting that train of thought and focusing on what has just happened. The last few seconds, focus on that, not on where the train of thought is going. And the second part of it is to, at the same time as observing the thought or the emotion that you've just had, is to try and remember where it started, why it started, what's the association, what's the trigger, why did you get onto this negative or unproductive train of thought. This is what I've been trying to do for the last 20 years. And by doing this, you identify triggers, situations, people, it could even be something biological or physiological in yourself. It's hard to describe this. It's something you have to do for yourself, and it will make sense to you and only to you. Once you've identified these triggers, then the next time a trigger arises, or you are aware that something may be about to, what you may be about to go into a situation or a train of thought that could be a potential trigger, you can then try and pull out of that or counteract it, or say to yourself, okay, this may be about to trigger me into being negative, but I know that this trigger is artificial. These negative thoughts aren't really me, and you can hopefully arrest that or maybe even stop it before it starts. So that's the way I try to do self-remembering. And if you can get the knack of it, and you can persevere with it, it really does help gain control over the, well, what for me is an endless spiral of junk in my head. The other thing I find useful, when we've talked about overthinking, and I think most people do, what I found useful, I mean, it's not, unless you spend your entire life meditating, then you're never really going to be able to arrest your thoughts. And I don't think that's particularly desirable, because what's the point of life if you're just constantly meditating every day? Or you may as well just be asleep. I mean, it's, you know, I've done a lot of meditation in the past, and yes, it's enjoyable and invigorating and all that, but it's no way to spend your whole life. You know, you've got to sort of, you know, you've got to get out there and earn money and meet people and form relationships and do things and fulfill your ambitions and, you know, find meaning in your life, as we've talked about in previous episodes. So there are all these things you have to do. When you know, the thousands of years ago, the world was a very different place. And yet, if you wanted to, you could just sit under a tree and meditate for your whole life. But the world's moved on. You can't live like that anymore. I've lost my train of thought. That's a perfect example that I've forgotten what I was talking about there. If only I was recording it and I could go back and listen to it. One thing I found particularly useful, it's almost impossible to completely stop your thoughts, and again, you know, you wouldn't want to. If you stop all thoughts, you're brain dead. What I found useful is, for me personally, having an extremely hyperactive mind that goes off on negative tangents a lot, is to think, okay, I have this certain hyperactive level of thinking. I can't really turn that down to a significant extent. So what I personally find useful is channeling that thinking in another way. And I do that by writing novels, by doing podcasts, like making music, which is a hobby anyone with a computer can do now with free software. And it doesn't have to be something creative, but, you know, study a subject. Find something that you find really difficult, like, I don't know, quantum physics or something, and get 10 books on it from the library and read them and write essays on them. You know, if you were finding that you're spending too much time with your thoughts running away from you in a negative spiral, then use that time instead, you know, for something more productive. Spend 2 hours a day reading something difficult and studying it and writing essays about it, or do some sort of physical hobby. Part of Gurdjieff's work was he would get people to dig the garden for 8 hours a day, and after 2 hours they would be absolutely hating it and they'd say, can I stop? And he'd go, no, you've got another 6 hours to go. And he would do this. He wasn't, you know, I say, he wasn't like a cult leader sort of imprisoning people. He would do this himself as well, and it ruined his health and shortened his life. But the point of it was, if you're doing extreme hard physical work for hours on end, for a while you will hate it, but you will get to a point where, if you know you have to do it, you will get the sort of like what marathon runners call the second wind, where you're absolutely exhausted and you get a sort of a surge of energy and you feel much better. And you can get that through extreme physical exercise. I will often, if I'm out for a walk and I've done maybe 10 miles and I think, oh God, I'm exhausted, my feet are hurting, I'm going to get the bus home. I'll think, no, it's only another 3 miles home. No, I'm going to walk the 3 miles instead of getting the bus and giving up. I'm going to push through. And every time I do that, I feel much better when I get home, because I've made the effort. And it's, and that kind of physical exertion is really good for toning down negative thoughts, because you feel you've achieved something. And if you can achieve some sort of physical mastery over yourself, then it will, the corollary of that will be a sort of mental mastery over your thoughts and your brain as well. There we are then. That's it, folks. That's the end of episode 16 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life, the podcast. I remain Marcus Freestone. The usual brief exhortations to like the Facebook page, the Google Plus page, put a nice review on iTunes, etc., etc. And the main one still being, I'm afraid, money. Please buy the paperback. It's on Amazon now. $7.99 in the UK. It's $12 in America and equivalent prices everywhere else. Please tell people if you found this useful and spread the word and give me some money and see you next time. Bye.